Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Dispatch 21. As always, I'd like to start by thanking you guys for your support. I know I always say that, but it really does mean something to me when I log on to Patreon and see how many of you are behind this project. Not many people get the opportunity to do this full-time like I do. It's not something I take lightly, and I wouldn't be able to do it without you guys. Anyway, I thought we'd start this installment with an addendum to the last dispatch. As you might recall, listener Maxwell Neely Cohen asked about Napoleonic veterans in the USA. I gave what I thought was a pretty decent answer, but I neglected to mention a pretty interesting and well-known character, General Jean-Joseph Aimable Humbert. This is quite an oversight on my part. I actually visited General Humbert's gravesite when I was in New Orleans a few years ago. Or at least, his alleged gravesite. We'll get into that later. Humbert was born in 1767, making him about 2 years older than Napoleon. Like many young Frenchmen of his generation, he joined the National Guard after the outbreak of the War of the First Coalition. He quickly proved to be a talented soldier, rising rapidly through the ranks, fighting first in the Vendée against royalist rebels and then on the Rhineland front against the Habsburgs. In less than 2 years, he rose from sergeant to brigadier general. He is probably most famous in the English-speaking world for his expedition to Ireland. In 1798, at the height of the United Irishmen Rebellion, the French Republican government sent a small force under Humbert to aid their Irish allies. Unlike the previous much larger French invasion of Ireland under Lazare Hoche, Humbert was actually able to get ashore in Western Ireland, with about 1,000 French regulars. He was joined by several thousand armed Irish rebels, and this improvised army actually won several victories against the local loyalist militias. In fact, Humbert and his rebel allies were so successful that on August 31, 1798, they declared an independent Irish state. Humbert told the people of Ireland, quote, "After several unsuccessful attempts, behold, at last, Frenchmen arrived amongst you. Union, liberty, the Irish Republic, such is our cry. Let us march. Our hearts are devoted to you. Our glory is in your happiness." End quote. Stirring stuff, however, the timing of this expedition could have been better. By the time Humbert and his men arrived, the rebellion was practically over in most of the country. Other rebel armies had been active in Ireland only a few months earlier, but they had all been defeated and dispersed or massacred before the first French boot touched Irish soil. The British had been surprised by Humbert's arrival, and even more surprised by his early success. But once they got over the shock and began marshaling their forces, the small ragtag Franco-Irish army stood little chance. They suffered a catastrophic defeat at the Battle of Ballinamuck in September of 1798, and Humbert was taken prisoner. The general and his French officers were soon exchanged for British prisoners held by the French, but his Irish officers were not so lucky. Most were tried for treason and executed, even those among them who had taken French citizenship and held commissions in the French army. The Irish rebel soldiers didn't even get trials. Most were simply massacred on the battlefield. Humbert fought again during the War of the Second Coalition, including under André Masséna at the Second Battle of Zurich, one of Masséna's greatest triumphs. He was also sent to Haiti as a part of General Leclerc's notorious expedition of 1801. However, he seems not to have endeared himself to his fellow officers on the expedition, because he was soon dismissed by Leclerc and sent back to France. I have seen different explanations as to why he was sent home, including some interesting ones. That he was having an affair with Leclerc's wife, Pauline Bonaparte, sister of Napoleon. That might sound like a tall tale, but Humbert was quite handsome and had a reputation as a ladies' man, and Pauline Bonaparte was well known for her weakness for handsome young generals. According to another story, Humbert was colluding with the Haitian rebels. The more prosaic version of the story is that Humbert was embezzling from his own units, although that was actually not uncommon, so even if it was true, there might have been something else going on as well. In any case, in my book, it's a badge of honor to be rejected by the gang of vicious murderers and sadists who composed the officer corps of the Leclerc expedition, but I digress. Shortly after his return to France, Humbert was dismissed from the army, despite the fact that he was still just 36 years old, and his service record was quite impressive, other than the one black mark of his dismissal by Leclerc. Some sources claim he was dismissed for his outspoken Republican views. He would certainly not have been the only left-wing officer who was dismissed ahead of Napoleon's coronation. Whatever happened in Haiti might have played a role as well. He returned to the army at some point in 1809 or 1810, but didn't stay long. After his brief return to the ranks, Humbert emigrated to New Orleans, which had only recently become part of the United States. He formed a friendship with the famous, or perhaps infamous, corsair, criminal, and general swashbuckler Jacques Lafitte. Some of you may have heard of Lafitte before. He was a major figure in the early history of American New Orleans. Apparently, Humbert and Lafitte were involved in all kinds of intrigues, but Lafitte's biography is so full of tall tales and exaggerations that I'm not sure which of these stories are true. Humbert next appears in Argentina, where he commanded a corps of patriot troops fighting for independence against the Spanish crown. However, once again, he did not stay long. Less than a year later, he was back in New Orleans, and once again, we don't know why. He arrived back in his adopted city just in time for the war to find him again. In 1814, with the British bearing down on the city, Humbert volunteered for the American militia and fought under General Andrew Jackson, Old Hickory, in the famous Battle of New Orleans. Apparently, he wore his old French Republican uniform. General Jackson was so impressed with Humbert that he mentioned him by name in the dispatches, a very high honor. Quote, "General Humbert, who offered his services as a volunteer, has constantly exposed himself to the greatest dangers with his characteristic bravery." End quote. However, Humbert's assertive attitude seems to have rubbed some of Jackson's officers the wrong way. The remarkable American victory at New Orleans would be Humbert's last adventure, or at least his last documented adventure. He was a well-known and well-liked character among the city's French-speaking population, but seems to have fallen into poverty and depression, dying at the age of 56. There is a persistent rumor that in his later years, Humbert was at the center of a conspiracy aimed at breaking Napoleon out of imprisonment on St. Helena and bringing him to New Orleans, but all these stories are heavy on speculation, light on evidence. I have my doubts. For one thing, Humbert didn't particularly like Napoleon. Then again, he was an adventurous character, and there is a lot of mystery around his life. We don't even know for sure where he was buried. There is a memorial to him at Saint-Louis Cemetery No. 1, just northwest of the French Quarter in New Orleans. But apparently there is some doubt as to whether or not he's actually there. Perhaps fitting for a man who was shrouded in mystery and never stayed in one place very long. According to another story, Humbert was buried elsewhere, and his body was disinterred later in the 19th century, as the city of New Orleans grew by leaps and bounds, and former graveyards were demolished for development. According to this story, Humbert's skull was appropriated by a prominent local Freemason for use in esoteric rituals. Humbert himself was a Freemason, so perhaps he wouldn't have objected. That might sound a bit outlandish, but a lot of the details of Humbert's life are quite outlandish. And we are talking about 19th century New Orleans here. If there ever was a setting in which a story like that might be true, it was this one. Aside from his possible gravesite in New Orleans, there are several memorials to Humbert in Western Ireland. Although Humbert and his men were only active in the area for a few months, they seem to have made quite an impression on the locals. After most of Ireland gained its independence in the 1920s, the new government sent out anthropologists and folklorists around the country, hoping to reclaim their history after centuries of foreign domination. They found that in Connaught and Western Leinster, the locals were still telling stories of the heroic French general who had led a doomed fight for Ireland's freedom over 100 years in the past. I would guess that between his exploits in Ireland and his time in New Orleans, Humbert is one of the best-remembered French revolutionary generals in the English-speaking world, despite all the mystery around his biography. Friend of the show Colin Mackemson brought my attention to another Napoleonic veteran of some note who ended up in New Orleans, Pierre Buisson, who went by his middle name, the slightly more English-friendly Benjamin, in America. Buisson was much younger than Humbert, born in 1793, so obviously he was far too young to take part in any of the events of the Revolution or the early phases of the Napoleonic Wars. He was commissioned as a lieutenant of artillery at the tail end of Napoleon's reign, serving in the final campaigns of the Napoleonic Wars, including at Waterloo. His service was brief, but apparently Buisson was a good soldier, because he was awarded the Medal of the Legion of Honor. He emigrated to New Orleans shortly after the Emperor's final defeat. In America, Buisson tried his hand at several different occupations, including architecture and publishing, but he really found success as a surveyor, and what we today would call an urban planner. Several cities in Louisiana have Buisson to thank for laying out neighborhoods in the Central Core, including New Orleans. If you've ever walked through New Orleans and noticed how many streets seem to reference important locations from Napoleon's life, you were not imagining things. As the New Orleans Daily Picayune put it, quote, "As might be expected, the names reflect the history of the man whom all his life Buisson most admired, his general and emperor, Napoleon." End quote. Milan Street, Jena Street, Marengo Street, and, of course, Napoleon Avenue, were all named by Buisson. There was also once a Berlin Street, but it was renamed General Pershing Street in a fit of patriotic fervor during World War I, despite the fact that the road was actually named for a great French victory over the Germans, and thus very fitting for the moment. On the eve of the American Civil War, Buisson was pushing 70. It had been almost half a century since he had worn a military uniform, but that didn't stop him from joining the Confederate forces. Buisson was made a brigadier general, testament to the lack of trained and experienced officers at the outbreak of war. He remained in his adopted city, raising and training volunteer regiments and preparing the defenses. All this activity is impressive for a man of his age, especially one who had not been in the military since his early 20s. But as those of you who know your Civil War history are already aware, the Confederate defenses of New Orleans were nothing to be proud of. In 1862, the brilliant Union Admiral David Farragut blasted his way up the Mississippi, and the Bluecoats took the city with very little resistance. This event is usually not even referred to as a battle, but as the taking of New Orleans, or the capture of New Orleans, because the Confederates were not even able to muster a token defense. Still, this humiliation seems not to have diminished Buisson's reputation. He died in 1874, a well-liked and well-respected member of the community. A lot of this information on Buisson came from a website called 64 Parishes, which has a lot of interesting articles on the history and culture of Louisiana. It is definitely worth checking out if you found this segment interesting. Anyway, now on to your questions. First, James Ryan asked, "What music did Napoleon enjoy listening to? What is the music that introduces your show, and how and why did you choose it?" As I've mentioned in the past, Napoleon loved music. Even when he was at the height of his power, busy with a thousand different things, he still made time to attend the opera and the orchestra quite regularly. He once wrote, quote, "Of all the fine arts, music is the one which has the most influence on the emotions. And it is this influence which the legislator must encourage most warmly. A piece of moral music, won by the hand of a master, cannot fail to touch the heart, and has much more influence than a good moral piece of writing, which moves the mind, but has no effect on behavior." End quote. As I mentioned in our episode on Napoleonic art, although Bonaparte loved culture, he had a bit of a Philistine streak. He liked didactic art that taught good morals. He didn't have much use for art that reveled in beauty for beauty's sake, or explored darker or less serious themes. I think you can see that attitude in that quotation. Despite his love of music, he was totally lacking in any musical talent of his own. He never learned to play an instrument and could barely even whistle a tune. Many people who knew him closely commented on his horrible singing voice. Quote, "In fact, Napoleon's voice was most unmusical, nor do I think he had any ear for music, for neither on this occasion nor in any of his subsequent attempts at singing could I ever discover what tune it was he was executing. He was, nevertheless, a good judge of music." End quote. According to his secretary, Meneval, who we've quoted from several times in the past, Napoleon's choice of tune could provide useful hints to his mood. If he was happy, he sang folk songs or opera. If he was in a more serious mood, he sang patriotic anthems. He considered Italian music to be the best in the world, maintaining it was far superior to French music, even after he rose to power in France. Perhaps unsurprisingly, he detested English music, saying, quote, "Their music is vile, the worst in the world," end quote. If you'll think back to episode 57, you'll recall that Napoleon was a well-known admirer of the Austrian composer Joseph Haydn, which is a big reason Georges Cadoudal and his fellow royalist plotters chose to unleash their infernal machine on Bonaparte on his way to a performance of Haydn's The Creation. Napoleon was known to make last-minute cancellations to his schedule, but everyone knew that he would be unlikely to miss such a high-profile performance of an iconic work by one of his favorite composers. True enough, on the night of the performance, Napoleon was exhausted and in a foul mood. Maybe if his engagement that evening had been something less appealing, he would have canceled. But he went anyway, and was almost blown to kingdom come. The composer most closely associated with Napoleon was an Italian named Giovanni Paisiello, who he employed as an official court composer. It was Paisiello who composed the iconic Te Deum for Napoleon and Josephine's coronation. I think music aficionados of the Napoleonic era would be surprised to learn that Mozart, Haydn, and Beethoven are widely known today, but Paisiello is a name only really known by serious scholars of classical music. In Napoleon's day, he would have very much been considered a peer of those other composers. Paisiello's music was well-regarded and influential, but that's how culture is. Fairly or unfairly, not everything stands the test of time. Even Napoleon's favorites were not above his criticism. The German writer and composer Johann Friedrich Reichardt recalled a performance of a new piece by Paisiello, attended by Napoleon. Quote, "Bonaparte sat facing the singers, astride a chair, his arms folded over the chair back, his head resting on his arms, silent and motionless during the performance. You would have thought that he was asleep. Once the act was over, he stood up and addressed Paisiello with a series of remarks concerning the mistakes in the prosody, words badly cut by the music and repeated pointlessly, breaks cutting the dramatic interest in the vocal line. At a loss, faced with this bold criticism, poor Paisiello didn't know how to defend himself." Bonaparte revealed on this occasion more knowledge of music and poetry than one would have suspected in a man generally considered to be indifferent to the fine arts. End quote. That last part is interesting. Maybe Reichardt needed to listen to our episode on Napoleonic fine art. Anyway, as to the second part of your question, the music that introduces and ends most episodes of the show is called Veillons au salut de l'Empire, or in English, Let Us Ensure the Salvation of the Empire. We discussed this in detail in Dispatch 14, but to briefly review, Napoleonic France had no official national anthem. This was probably the most prominent of several patriotic songs that were used as unofficial national anthems during Napoleon's reign. According to Meneval, it was also one of those patriotic songs that Napoleon would sing or whistle when he was in a serious mood. As to why I chose it, it was actually my second choice. I originally wanted a different patriotic anthem from this era, the Song of the Departure. According to Meneval, this song was also part of Napoleon's repertoire when he was in a serious mood. We discussed the Song of the Departure and read some of the lyrics all the way back in episode 17. I've always found it to be a catchier tune than Let Us Ensure the Salvation of the Empire, but I couldn't find a recording of it that really suited my needs. Next, Michael Bernabeau asked, "As a fan of the Sharp books, one thing that appears every so often is the French column, and how the British could beat it, particularly at Waterloo. I just watched the Napoleon movie, and I did not see a French column in that battle. My question is, was the French column really as ubiquitous as Cornwell writes? This trope is certainly present in the Sharp novels, but not exclusively. You see it in all kinds of popular media about the Napoleonic Wars. This idea that the assault column was some kind of signature tactic of the French army. Usually the British are presented as a counterpoint, preferring to fight on the defensive in line formation and receiving the French columns. There is a grain of truth to this. French doctrine did favor the offensive, and the column was a popular formation for fast movement on the battlefield. Many of the iconic battles between French and British forces from this era did involve French assaults trying to break British lines, including, most famously, the attack of the Imperial Guard at Waterloo. But if you think about this for a second, any army of any era would be pretty foolish to always rely on the same tactic in every battle, wouldn't they? The history of the Napoleonic Wars is full of counterexamples to this stereotype. By and large, the commanders of this period knew their business very well, and they employed whatever tactics were best suited to any given situation. A lot of this stereotype of columns versus lines can be traced back to Sir Charles Oman, a British historian who wrote extensively about the Napoleonic Wars in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Oman was almost unbelievably prolific. His History of the Peninsular War runs 7 volumes, and took him roughly 30 years to write. So just imagine that if you think I'm going too slowly. There is a lot to praise about Oman. He was a good writer with an obvious passion for the subject. Even now, coming up on 100 years after the final volume of his Peninsular War series was published, it is still widely read, and his accounts of some of these battles remain definitive, at least in English. It's hard to understate his significance in the field of Napoleonic history in the English-speaking world, particularly in his native UK. However, there is a lot to criticize about Oman as well. The study of history was much less professional in his time than it is today. In his own time, Oman was renowned as a skilled and tireless researcher, but he didn't have access to a lot of the methods and tools that are routinely used even by amateur scholars today. He was also very much a man of his era. Oman was a chauvinist, who took a pretty dim view of anything and anyone that wasn't British. He particularly loathed the French, considering them by and large bad generals, bad soldiers, and I would go so far as to say, bad people. As Oman himself put it, quote, "French tacticians of the Napoleonic Wars were rather stupid and blind to the most fundamental principles of infantry fighting," end quote. Perhaps his jaundiced view of the French makes some sense, given that his specialty was the Peninsular War. This is probably the theater of the Napoleonic Wars where the French military performed the worst, and also probably the theater of the war where they behaved the second worst, after Haiti. Then again, with all that said, it takes a lot of ego to dismiss the man who conquered half the continent as stupid and blind to some of the fundamental principles of their profession. Setting that aside, if we entertain Oman's argument that the French were stupid and incompetent, it begs the question, how were they so successful for so many years? The period between the outbreak of the War of the First Coalition and Napoleon's final defeat represents about 20 years of military dominance, which is a long time for people who were allegedly stupid and blind. To Oman, the assault column was the answer to this question. He believed the French compensated for their lack of skill by essentially overpowering their enemies with the brute force of massed assault columns. This theory of the French column versus the British line is obviously very flattering to the British. The idea of the French as bumbling incompetents, made dangerous only by the brutal fanaticism of their troops and their officers' willingness to throw away the lives of their men. This is a classic way chauvinists devalue and denigrate their military enemies. The Germans talked about the Soviets in much the same terms during the Second World War. If you're American, you may have heard a similar line about the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese during the Vietnam War, or the North Korean and Chinese forces of the Korean War. Modern historians who have examined this question generally disagree with Oman. More systematic studies of Napoleonic tactics and doctrine have concluded that French generals actually preferred the line formation, and conversely, the British were perfectly capable of using the same types of mixed-order formations that were used by the French on the attack. Today, consensus seems to be that pure column formations were rarely, if ever, used for frontal assaults. Units were often formed up in columns because this was the best formation for rapid movement. But generals from every army were well aware of the weaknesses of the column in combat situations, most notably the lack of firepower. And so, attacking columns were almost always redeployed or modified before they got close to the enemy. As far as I know, there aren't any serious scholars currently working in the field who still cling to Oman's old red line versus blue column dichotomy, but you do still sometimes see traces of the underlying attitude, the British as solid professionals, standing firm as the roguish French try to overwhelm them with revolutionary fervor and fanatical loyalty to the emperor. This view certainly remains very influential in Anglophone pop culture. You see it in the Sharp novels and movies, in video games, TV shows, and even in works of popular history. Ridley Scott seems to have dispensed with the column altogether and depicted the French army as essentially a mob. We've talked a lot about music in this episode, so I'd like to close things out with a song. In honor of St. Patrick's Day, here is a traditional Irish tune about the Napoleonic Wars. Fare Thee Well, Enniskillen, performed by the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem. As always, thanks for listening.
Our troop was made ready at the dawn of the day. From lovely Enniskillen they were marching us away. They put us then on board a ship to cross the raging main. To fight in bloody battle in the sunny land of Spain. Fare thee well, Enniskillen, fare thee well for a while. And all around the borders of Erin's green isle. And when the war is over, we'll return in full bloom. And you'll all welcome home your Enniskillen dragoons. Well, Spain, it is a gallant land where wine and ale flow free. There's lots of lovely women there to dandle on your knee. And often in the tavern there we'd make our rafters ring. When every soldier in the house would raise his glass and sing. Fare thee well, Enniskillen, fare thee well for a while. And all around the borders of Erin's green isle. And when the war is over we'll return in full bloom. Ireland's glory there, and many a man did fall. From musket and from bayonet and from thundering cannonball. And many a foeman we laid low amid the battle throng. And as we prepared for action, you would often hear the song. Fare thee well, Enniskillen, fare thee well for a while. And all around the borders of Erin's green isle. And when the war is over, we'll return in full bloom. Fighting's over and for home we have set sail. Our flag above this lofty ship is fluttering in the gale. They've given us a pension, boys, a fourpence each a day. And when we reach Enniskillen, never more we'll have to say. Fare thee well, Enniskillen, fare thee well for a while.